Hollywood's annual Night of Nights is upon us with the Academy Awards. Today's guest helps us take stock of the film industry and the films singled out for their powerful storytelling this year. He's Pete Hammond, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to A Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University.
And I'm G. Wayne Miller, also with Salve's Pell Center.
And our guest this week is the awards columnist and chief film critic for Deadline. Pete Hammond joins us today from Los Angeles. Pete, it's great to be with you again.
Yeah, hi, nice to be back. It's that time of year.
It is that time of year, and this is we look forward to this every year, this conversation with you. And there's a lot we want to talk to you about, a lot of great films, but we're coming off of 2023 with a lot of disruption in the film industry, strikes in the Writers Guild and the Screen Actors Guild. How is the industry positioned now at the start of 2024?
Well, it's called catch up. The industry is trying to catch up because of these strikes, which went on for months. I happen to be in the Writers Guild, so I was right in the middle of that, too. But the actors' strike was really devastating, and so many projects that we might have been talking about now, we're not. For instance, Dune 2, which was considered to be a big Oscar contender, moved to 2024 and things like that because of the strikes. But everybody's back. It's up again in television. The seasons are finally starting. You can see by all the advertising going on in this with the Super Bowl coming up. So there's a good feeling and that we've caught up with this award season. Actors started being able to join in on all the Q&As and all the campaigning. And I think they've made up for lost time because it feels like it feels like it's 2019 all over again. No more pandemic. No more strikes. Some really good movies, to talk about. So I'm optimistic, actually.
That's great.
So you wrote in Deadline that there weren't any surprises for the Best Picture nominees. Can you just give us an overall assessment? We're going to get into each of the nominees in a moment. Just give us an overall assessment of this year's field, which is basically the films of 2023.
I mean, there's always surprises that people are surprised in one way or another, but I wasn't. I mean, literally, I went and predicted these would likely be the 10, and they were. You can always tell as the season goes along, the way what I call the precursor award shows and what's being handed out, what movies are in the mix and what movies are falling off. And so this is an exceptionally good group. It doesn't go way beyond this in terms of what they had to choose from in terms of top quality that would wind up with a Best Picture nomination. But what I think was key and what I thought was going to happen is it's very international this year. And the Academy in recent years has really upped the ante in terms of bringing in new members from around the globe and making themselves into a truly global organization. And so right back at Cannes, which I always go to the Cannes Film Festival, you could see the way it was going even back in May. And, when movies debuted there like Anatomy of a Fall and The Zone of Interest and won the big awards in Cannes. And then we saw Martin Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon debut there. And so we saw an early beginning of this Oscar race, that this was going to be a very good year, particularly a good year for the international films, I think, too.
And we're going to talk about some of those international films, but let's start with two American films that have been sort of stitched together since they released a week apart or the same weekend last summer, Barbie and Oppenheimer. We'll take those in turn, but I want to start with Barbie because you, unlike a lot of other film critics out there, saw in it last summer that it had picture of the year potential. What did you see that so many others missed?
Well, I went to the premiere And, you know, that was before we could even do reviews. And I actually didn't review it for Deadline. We had our female critic, Valerie, review it. But those reviews were embargoed for another week. But I decided I really want to write about this movie after seeing it at its premiere at the Shrine. So the next day I wrote a column suggesting that this could be a major Oscar contender. And some people just laughed at me. Somebody in print said it's the dumbest thing Deadline's written. And all of these things. And I just want to point out, if you're watching this, sorry, but no, this was evident to me that this movie was different. It was smart. It was funny. It was not, you know, what you might have expected going in, what a Barbie movie. And that's all due to Greta Gerwig and the script, which she co-wrote with Noah Baumbach, her husband. Just brilliant. And so I decided I'd write about it. I said, here it is. And it's turned out to be true, which is really terrific, I think, for that film. And it's well-deserving. I'm only sorry that they snubbed Greta Gerwig in the director category, because I thought she did a spectacular job in this. It's evident, you know, not only in its critical acclaim when it came out, but being the biggest picture of the year, well over $1 billion globally. I mean, it just hit the zeitgeist, and it was extraordinary.
And so the Academy also passed over Margot Robbie for her portrayal, but Ryan Gosling was nominated. Does that really not affirm what the message of Barbie was?
A lot of people say that, and that was a little controversy that we had coming out of the Oscar nominations. Well, you know, Barbie doesn't get nominated, but Ken does. Yes, I think you could say that. I think it's also, there was an exceptionally strong list of actresses. Comedy doesn't always get its due in the Academy, particularly in acting, and she was just perfect in the role, but easier to overlook than some of these heavier performances, maybe, that the actors branch decided to choose. It happens. Look, you know, that it's a democratic process. People vote, and, you know, someone's always going to come up short. In the director's race, though, I am calling for the Academy to just have 10 directors able to be nominated to match the 10 pictures that they nominate, because it suggests if you only have 5 slots for directors, that 5 of those movies they've deemed the best of the year apparently just directed themselves, because, you know, 5 directors are not going to get nominated to match those movies. I really think they need to change that process. And then we wouldn't have had this controversy about Greta and her missing out there. But we can't blame it because they ignored women, because Justine Triet of Anatomy of a Fall is among the nominees in director.
All right, so on to Oppenheimer. So this one did not surprise you in its inclusion in the Best Picture category. What makes this film so compelling?
Well, first of all, I mean, it's released in the middle of July, which is Christopher Nolan's good luck date, but his movies in the past have been like The Dark Knight and Inception and Interstellar and these big blockbuster type of movies. So a 3-hour adult movie, much of it in black and white, opens and does nearly $1 billion, opens in the middle of summer. For that reason alone, it's telling the industry people want original movies, as does Barbie. This whole Barbenheimer craze is really saying, give us something new and we will come. We will show up in droves, and around the globe they did. Part of that's due to Christopher Nolan's own following. He has a very big following, and they will go wherever he wants to take him. But this was a risky bet, because this is a historical film. It's not exactly what you expect it to be. And it proved that you can make something with substance that also, I think, resonates today. It's a very important subject. It's an incredibly important subject, and about the beginnings of the atomic bomb. And the questioning of its lead title character, J. Robert Oppenheimer. So it's amazing, you know, and it's amazing that those two movies were able to play off of each other and become this phenomenon, this social phenomenon. So I think that made it irresistible to the Academy, because first of all, the Academy has no memory. Usually you have to open these movies in the fall, and here you had two in the middle of the summer. And that they're going all the way, you know, combined total of 21 nominations between them. And I do think Oppenheimer's the front runner by far. I think the Academy will want to reward this film and Christopher Nolan for everything it's done for the industry. And, you know, in many ways, changed the industry.
You know, you mentioned the box office numbers that both of these films put up last summer. I think we had you on, the first year we had you on, it was the middle of the pandemic. We were still producing from our own homes, and nobody was going to movie theaters, right? And there was real question and concern about the viability of theaters as a venue for people, for audiences to go see film. Have those questions been put to bed forever?
I think so. I mean, there are questions about, you know, streaming versus theatrical opening in theaters, too. But it's really moved to theatrical, which can prove that people will come out. That's all we needed to know. Were movie theaters dead? That was the question we were asking then. And the answer is no. But I've talked to many filmmakers, Steven Spielberg being one of them, who says he wasn't sure if we were ever going to have theaters viable again. And so, you know, that's why he rushed to make West Side Story. He wanted it in theaters. He thought maybe this is going to be the last time.
Oh, wow.
There was those questions. And I think the success of these movies have answered that. I think the success of Top Gun Maverick last year also answered that clearly. You know, when you have filmmakers insisting that their films play in theaters, that's a good thing, and it's worked out for those movies that people want to go see, that they'll talk about. And, you know, it's a communal experience, movie theaters, and seeing movies this way. And particularly comedies like Barbie, you want that reaction around you, and it just feeds off of itself. You can't get that sitting on your couch watching Netflix. I'm sorry. And the nominations for Best Picture really reflect that. Netflix is the only one that really has a straight-to-streaming movie, and that was Maestro. And even that, they gave, you know, their usual nominal theatrical release. But nevertheless, these movies all got to play theaters this year and have proven their worth in that way.
So let's keep going through the list. And the next one we want you to tell us about is American Fiction.
Yes. American Fiction is such a smart, funny satire, but it's also got an emotional hook to it. It's also about family. But it's a new feature film director. He's never made a movie before, but he's worked in television as a writer, won Emmys. Cord Jefferson adapted this book and turned it into a film that became the surprise here. But we first saw it at the Toronto Film Festival, where it won the Audience Award. And that was a key thing. That was a thing that was going to tell us that this could go all the way, because when you win the Audience Award at Toronto, that's an indication right there that you're going to get a Best Picture nomination. It is uncanny. And that won over anything. And so I knew then that American Fiction was going to be a contender. But you never know in the end if enough people are going to see it, but they are seeing it. But it's the late breaking one of this season, I think.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard multiple times every weekend on SiriusXM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a really great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. And joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is an award-winning journalist and the author of 21 books. And our guest this week is the awards columnist and chief film critic for Deadline, our friend Pete Hammond, who's helping us sort through this year's Academy Award nominees. Yeah, so one of the international films, you mentioned that I think there are two in this crop of Best Picture nominees, but one is Anatomy of a Fall. And when I saw this, my wife and I watched it together, and we spent the next several days talking about this film.
Yes, you liked it.
I did.
Everyone seems to really like this film. It actually won the Best Screenplay Award over anything at the Golden Globes this year. It was the Palme d'Or winner in Cannes. I saw it in Cannes. I could tell this is an amazing movie. It's a French movie. And oddly enough, you know, each country has to enter its own movie into the Oscar race for Best Foreign Film, International Film. And France chose a different picture, The Taste of Things. This one probably could have won in that category, but it wasn't chosen. So instead, it's up for Best Picture and Screenplay, and she's up for Best Director, Justine Triet. It's an intriguing, really interesting movie. Did she do it? Did she not do it in terms of the death of her husband? And it's exceptionally well acted by Sandra Hüller, who's up for lead actress for this movie. And it's one of those movies I think is going to do very well on Oscar night. You can tell because people really respond to it. It's also showing the power of the international voter bloc in the Academy to put it up for Best Picture. The same year, they have nominated The Zone of Interest, the movie that came in number two in the awards at Cannes, also blew it away in Cannes. So you have two international movies nominated for Best Picture. That's a first. Right there, two movies in a foreign language. That's really showing a new sign. And then you have a third, too, if I might mention Past Lives, which actually debuted way back at the Sundance Film Festival. And that half of that's in Korean, even though that's not an American financed film. That one also is showing audiences have the patience now for subtitles in movies.
So let's take, since you mentioned those other two films with subtitles, let's talk about those. The Zone of Interest, that's a movie I can't shake. again, another international film, but powerful and sort of a gut check in a number of really profound ways.
It blew me away when I saw it in Cannes at 8:30 in the morning. I didn't know what it was. In Cannes, they just give you like one log line synopsis, and it said, you know, Nazi commandant runs Auschwitz, and that's all it said. So I thought, well, okay, what is this? And I said, I want to review this. I will go and review it. But I walked out of that movie, and I just have never seen a movie quite like that. It was extraordinary in that it's telling the story of the Holocaust from the other side. It's showing the life of the paradise, as they call it, that the German commandant and his family lived right across from Auschwitz. But you see that in the background. You see the smoke rising. You hear faint screams. And all of that, these sounds. And interestingly, The Zone of Interest is also nominated for Best Sound. And there's a reason, you know, because it's not the obvious big blockbuster movie kind of with big sound. It's subtle. And I was really happy that got a nomination there. But that's up for Best Picture as well, and Director and Screenplay. I think it's worked around the world in showing this from a different point of view, different standpoint. And it's so powerful.
So tell us about Past Lives, another one nominated.
Well, that's about a Korean American woman here who lives with her husband, who's an American and lives in New York, and then has a meeting. Suddenly, someone from her earlier life in Korea comes to New York, and it's a reunion of sort. Hence the title Past Lives, and she is balancing her current life and sort of reliving where she came from with this relationship. And it's a beautifully made movie. A first-time feature director, Celine Song, who is also up for her screenplay. It's only got two nominations, but Greta Lee, who's in it, who's also in this movie, in the TV series The Morning Show, a wonderful, known for comedy, really got to do a fine dramatic performance. She should have been nominated for lead actress, but there wasn't enough room for her either. She and Margot Robbie, you know, both kind of got aced out of that category, but it's definitely worth seeing. And it's a small movie, and it debuted at Sundance, and it became the big hit of the Sundance Film Festival way back in January of 2023. So it was remembered, you know, for a whole year to get into this race. And it's probably the smallest film, but it's certainly one worth seeing.
So let's talk about The Holdovers, which I found charming and quirky. sort of a part coming of age, part buddy film, I thought.
Yeah, I love that movie. But I loved Alexander Payne, who directed it and has done, you know, Nebraska and Sideways and About Schmidt and on and on and on, you know, The Descendants. He is just a humanist kind of filmmaker, makes movies about people. And this is really about three people, you know, held over during the holidays because this kid, the young kid, has nowhere to go. So they have to basically chaperone him, keep him there at school. And so it's just him, this cranky professor played to the hilt by Paul Giamatti, who is stuck there, and he is just perfection in this role. And then Divine Joy Randolph plays the school's cook, and she also has nowhere to go. Her son had recently died during a war, and this is set in 1971, so he had been in Vietnam. And it's the three of them making a temporary family. And it's just such it's a comedy, but it'll also make you cry. It's one of those cliches, you know, you'll laugh, you'll cry. I mean, they don't make movies much like this anymore. And Alexander Payne purposely wanted to make it look like a movie that could have been made in 1971. He had, you know, the picture scratched up a little bit, like a film might look that time. The logos were from that period at the beginning of the movie with the title credits. And but the whole thing is just terrific. And it's written by David Hemmingson. This is one of only two movies that Payne did not write himself, but it was his idea. He had seen a movie at the Telluride Film Festival a few years ago called Le Mérousse, which is a 1935 French film that had sort of a similar premise of people being held over during the holidays at a prep school. But that's where it sort of ended. And this became a very original take on that, a similar idea.
So tell us now about Killers of the Flower Moon.
Remarkable.
What do you need to know except Martin Scorsese
made that movie. Leonardo DiCaprio.
And has received his 10th nomination.
Yeah,
he passed
incredible.
Spielberg in terms of nominees,
really?
Nominations for directing, and he's only a couple behind William Wyler of all time. I mean, Scorsese's just a master, but this is his first Western, what they call a Western, very different than what we look at most Westerns like, telling the horrifying story of what actually happened 100 years ago on the Osage Nation with these women, Osage women, who hit the oil. They hit the a lot of instant wealth, and the men there, the evil men, found a way to marry in to each of these families, kill off these women, and take back that money, that wealth that the Osage just sort of happened onto by accident. It's a horrifying story, shot right where it happened in Oklahoma and among the Osage Nation, and cast very authentically, right down the line with actors who are not, you know, it used to be Hollywood would cast Anthony Quinn or people like that to play, you know, Native Americans, yeah, and Natalie Wood, you know, and The Searchers and things like that. But now it's got to be authentic. And you have Lily Gladstone, the lead of that, the first Native American actress to be nominated for Best Actress, and very deserving. But this is a powerful movie. It's 3.5 hours. So it's truly epic, but it tells a tale that'll keep you riveted, I think. And that's why it has 10 nominations and up for Best Picture as well. And if you read the book, David Grand's book, it really departs from that. They, halfway through the writing of it, they decided to go another direction and tell it from the point of view of the Osage rather than the beginnings of the FBI, which the book is really what that's about.
You know, we've got about 3 minutes left here and two films, so we might go a little bit quicker than we want to, but Maestro. Bradley Cooper keeps producing remarkable work. I'm still thinking about his performance a couple of years ago in Nightmare Alley. Tell us now, he wrote, directed, and starred in Maestro.
Yeah, and produced. He co-produced it with Steven Spielberg and Martin Scorsese, both of whom at one time were going to direct this themselves. They've stayed on as producers, and Bradley got wind when Spielberg decided to do West Side Story and said, he said, let me take a crack at it. I'll show you a little movie I just directed for my first movie called A Star Is Born. It hadn't opened yet. And they said, you're hired. Do it. And so he directed himself. He is now, here's a good statistic for you. He's only the fourth person in Academy history to direct himself to a Best Actor Oscar nomination twice.
Wow.
And the others are Clint Eastwood, Warren Beatty, and Laurence Olivier, who actually did it three times. But that is a significant thing. It tells you about his talent as a director, and he co-wrote it with Josh Singer, and is spectacular as Leonard Bernstein. But it's really the story of Leonard Bernstein's marriage and family and all of that and who he was. And musically, it's stunning. It's amazing movie. So that is Netflix. That's the only real streaming movie among the 10 this year. Killers of the Flower Moon comes from Apple, but it was released theatrically by Paramount first.
So the last of the 10 is Poor Things. Tell us about that.
Don't discount Poor Things. I saw that at Telluride. And I could tell audiences really eat it up. It's a wild movie. It's from the Greek director Yorgos Lanthimos, who did The Favorite. And Emma Stone probably will run away with the Best Actress Oscar. It's just an offbeat story. It's kind of a fairy tale fantasy where they create this woman who's all good for sex but has the mind of a five-year-old. But then, like Barbie, she gets religion and she figures out things and she may be smarter. That's sort of the point of Poor Things, but it's a wild movie, beautifully designed, and it's funny. It is a comedy, but unlike any other one this year. That's got 11 nominations. That's one to look for. If it's going to be an upset, it's going to be with that movie.
Pete, do you have the best job in Hollywood?
Or in the world?
Or in the world, for that matter. Yeah, seriously.
Yeah, I think Brad Pitt does, but whatever.
Hey, Pete Hammond, you're welcome here anytime. Thank you so much for being with us. He's Pete Hammond. He's in Deadline, and you'll see him all over the awards in the next couple of weeks. That's all the time we have this week for Story in the Public Square, but if you want to know more, you can find us on social media or visit pellcenter.org. We can always catch up on previous episodes. He's Wayne. I'm Jim, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.